To resources to order. Monday, March 7th. How could it be that already? We have the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Katie, do you want to come up and get us started? I guess I should call you Katie Koba or Director Koba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the department. I also wanted to take a minute and introduce the chair of our board who has joined us today, Bernie Faber, with the cow tie on. Bernie's a dairy farmer in West Salem, but he always makes sure to introduce himself as someone who represents all of agriculture and not just the dairy industry. Mr. Chairman, today our plan is to give you a quick industry overview and an agency overview and just a few slides on our budget summary. We hope to finish that in 45 minutes, and then we want to dive into performance measures, and our goal is to get about a third to a half of the way through our performance measures. We have a lot of them. It's very complicated, and we're going to try to lead you by the hand through those so we don't lose you in that discussion. And then tomorrow we will finish up with performance measures and move into our prioritized program list and 10% cut list. And we have 2 days scheduled with you, so our plan is to be done tomorrow afternoon.
Well, the further you get before everybody is here, the less questions.
I think you're right. So I'm going to go fast. Obviously, we can find pretty pictures to portray the industry, but agriculture certainly is more than just a pretty picture. It is Oregon's second largest traded sector industry behind high tech. There are many who feel that as part of a natural resources economy, perhaps agriculture is slowly dying, and that is not at all the truth. If you account for agriculture as well as food processing and all the inputs that go into production and processing, the industry accounts for 8 to 9% of jobs in Oregon and 9.5% of Oregon's gross state product. Times are good right now in agriculture. We have rebounded from a few tough years in the late 90s going into early 2000. And since 2001-2002, the value of farm gate agricultural output has now reached an all-time high of $3.8 billion in 2003-04. And net farm income is another figure that we like to keep close track of. And it also suffered in the late 90s and into early 2000. But in 2002, showed a 21% increase, and in 2003, improved by 30%. So agriculture in Oregon is doing well.
Katie, those figures, is that increased production or value of production or combinations of things to get those figures?
The $3.8 billion is the value of production. So that would be what producers are able to sell their product for, and we have seen some high prices in the last couple of years, certainly for the beef industry, but for many other sectors of agriculture. So that certainly contributes to that all-time high. So to summarize, agriculture's contribution to the economy, $3.8 billion in farm gate value. You add to that about $1.5 billion in food processing value, plus all related inputs and associated economic activity. It equates to $11.5 billion that ag food processing contributes to Oregon's economy. And this is based on a very conservative 2.2 multiplier for the industry. Here's a graphic detail of the farm gate value at $3.8 billion. You can see the trend line has been steady since 1985. Agriculture just continues to be a steady contributor to Oregon's economy. You can see, and I think, like I said, it's important to keep your eye on the net farm income. That figure doesn't go up on the same kind of trend line as the value of production. And producers have done very well since 2001. We've seen that increase in net farm income, but there's a big disparity between net farm income and the total value of production, and the costs that go into the industry are something that are a big deal for us and something we need to pay attention to, such things as labor costs, costs for fuels, electricity for irrigation, fertilizers, chemicals, those kinds of things. In our industry, more than 150,000 people are engaged in various occupations related to agriculture, again, 8 to 9% of Oregon's employment, and it represents total payroll of over $2.3 billion. If there's one word to describe the industry in Oregon, the word I use is diverse. We're not a Midwest state in terms of three or four or five commodities that dominate our production. We produce over 220 different commodities in Oregon, and certainly this helps create that stability that you see in our industry. In any given year, we can have one commodity that isn't doing well, but we usually have multiple commodities that are doing well. Here's a breakdown of the segments of Oregon agriculture, and again, it reflects the diversity, and I'm sorry, in your handout, you get black boxes. But again, you can see ranging from vegetables, cattle, dairy, poultry, grains, hay, forage, grass, all around. No real single entity that dominates the industry. And we'll go to a minute in a chart that does show the top 10 in terms of production. But a real nice graphic, I think, if you're in an ag state, to have that kind of diversity. Oregon leads the nation in the production of these commodities: grass seed, hazelnuts, Christmas trees, peppermint, cane berries, sugar beets for seed, crimson clover, red clover seed, herbs, and potted florist azaleas. So these are areas where Oregon produces the largest amount compared to any other state in the United States. And then we switch to those commodities that are ranked highest in Oregon, and very few of the commodities that you saw on the previous slide are on this slide. Nursery and greenhouse has been our number one segment of the industry for about a decade now, continues to increase in value of production. It's followed by cattle and calves, hay, grass seed, milk, wheat, Christmas trees, onions, potatoes, and pears. And typically those commodities stay in the top 10. They can switch places in any given year. Again, a nice representation of the diversity of the industry. In terms of where production takes place in the state, it's not just on the east side, or it's not just in rural counties. I think this is a very interesting set of information in that four of the top five ag-producing counties are in the Portland metro or valley area of the of Oregon, topped with Marion County, then followed by Clackamas and Washington County in the Portland metro area, and then Yamhill County is number four. The fifth top producing county is Umatilla County, Senator Nelson's home county in eastern Oregon, and then you can see the remainders. Then contrast this with the next slide. Oregon's top 10 agricultural counties by production per capita, and this is where you see the importance of agriculture to our rural counties. All of these counties would be east side with the exception of Tillamook. And again, you can see the importance of agriculture to our rural counties in Oregon. When you focus in on Oregon's top commodity, the greenhouse industry, you can see what drives some of this agriculture happening in the more urban areas of the state, leading in Marion, Clackamas, Washington, Yamhill, and Multnomah County, interestingly, all in the Portland metro area, and then, of course, Yamhill and Marion County here in the valley. And then when you combine the livestock industry, so combining both cattle and calves, dairy and other livestock and feedstocks, that makes up a significant amount of Oregon agriculture, $1.5 billion in farm gate sales. And this production tends to be in the more rural counties. So is Oregon agriculture big-time corporate farming? No, it is not. In Oregon, we have 40,000 farms and ranches. 88% of those are sole proprietors, family ownership. 5 to 7% are family-owned partnerships. 5 to 6% are family-owned corporations. Less than 1% of farms in Oregon are non-family-owned corporate entities. The average age of producers in the state, 55 years old. 54% of all growers are older than that, and they operate over 50% of farm acreage. Yes.
Yeah, you don't have to go back to this, but can you, when this line here, when the income has dips, do you see an increase in the concentration of farm ownership when these go down?
We'll get to a slide in terms of the concentration of farm ownership in a minute. Oregon is still bucking the national trend in terms of consolidation. We are still keeping our acres per farmer fairly low or declining as opposed to the national trend. But when you see the slide in a minute, it'll also paint a different picture for you. Again, the diversity of agriculture in Oregon also as well as the makeup. One of the things we're paying close attention to is the whole notion of land and land turnover in the next 10 to 15 years as these operators reach retirement age. Are there going to be folks in the family that come back to the farm and pick that up, or is there going to be sales? And if so, will it be to farmers or to someone else?
Katie, do you have any statistics on the average values of these farms and whether they can be passed on because of inheritance, anything of that nature?
I think we've got a slide in a minute that kind of shows the size of the farms, how much they have to gross to truly be self-sufficient, and that may get at some of your question, Mr. Chair. Here it is. It's kind of a compact slide, but I'll walk you through it. In terms of full-time commercial family farm operations, these are the farms where people are farming full-time and can make money and keep that job. In those cases, these operations need to have $250,000 in sales in order to operate full-time and provide for family living expenses. Only 6% of Oregon's farms are in this category, but those 6% of the farms produce 80% of the output. So there you can see where it's these full-time farms. It's a fairly small segment of Oregon's agriculture, but certainly that's where Oregon agriculture makes its money and is dominant both in the national and the international marketplace. Then you have this middle group, 25% of Oregon's farms producing about 18% of the output, but they do control 35% of the acreage. So they've got quite a bit of acreage above their percentage in terms of numbers. But these are the farms where perhaps the farmer has also got a second job, maybe trading in the commodities market or something like that, or a wife who works or other family members who work to keep this farm going. So I think that would be the question about when you get into this notion of turnover, whether those farms will stay in business under that kind of lifestyle or they'll go to something else. And then you have what people in the past have called part-time farms, hobby farms, lifestyle farms. 69% of Oregon farms, which have less than 10,000 in sales, they have less than 50 acres on average and less than 5% of output. People are doing this because it's a lifestyle that they choose to live. Person sitting right next to my left does this with sheep. Why she does it, I don't know, but she seems to think it's a good thing to do. So that's exactly right. So, and I would expect that these would stay kind of in that category, people that value that kind of a lifestyle. Did that get at your question for both of you, do you think?
Kind of. I just kind of wondered how many of those upper two would be getting into a problem of passing on their farm to a family member because of the state problems.
Mr. Chair, I think you're going to have a better chance with the top group, and Senator Nelson, you may want to chime in there. I think the area that I would keep a close eye would be that middle group where they're having to have another job in order to make the farm work.
That's why I'm in the legislature, because we got such a big pay.
This pay looks good compared to work. We need to talk.
Exports are absolutely critical for Oregon agriculture. 80% of what we produce leaves our state borders. 40% or more of that production leaves the country. Ag and food products are the second largest export sector in terms of value, and they are the first in exports in terms of volume. Ag exports account for about 19% of total state exports, and 60% of the Port of Portland's total tonnage of exports is agriculture. So again, ag and agricultural exports are something that we pay a lot of attention to, and we spend a lot of time marketing our products both domestically and internationally.
Mr. Schaffer, do you have another question?
Yeah, please. How many, the last bullet, how many jobs does that add up to in Port of Portland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but that is a statistic that we have, and we'll get that and get it back to you.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, agriculture is Oregon's second largest traded sector industry behind high tech, and you see this in exports as well. Computer and electronic products are Oregon's top exports at $4.2 billion per year, but this is a figure that's down 8.5% over the past year. Agricultural exports are up in the past year, 20.4%, for a total of $1.55 billion. If you add in processed food and other ag-related exports, you reach $1.83 billion. Our top agricultural export markets are Japan, followed by Korea, China, Canada, and Mexico. And we're active in all of those markets. Where does value added happen in the state? Interestingly enough, it's centered in the Portland metro area, over $1.5 billion in value added. Total statewide, 22,000 jobs, $665 million in payroll. But look at this slide. Multnomah County leads Oregon in food processing with more than 24% of the state's food processing payroll and nearly 20% of the employees. Marion County follows with 18% and 16% of the payroll. Average annual pay per worker in Multnomah County is $36,000 plus. In Marion County, it's nearly $27,000. So as we look in the future, in the crystal ball, two of the areas that we are paying a lot of attention to that we frankly have some concerns around are both land and water, which are absolutely critical to the viability of Oregon agriculture. Currently, in terms of a land base, 17 million acres of private land ownership is in farm use. Of that, 15.5 million is in commercial farm use. Those are farms that gross over 10,000 in sales, and that land is zoned as agricultural land. 1.5 million acres are in those lifestyle farms at less than 10,000 in sales. Further breaking down that 17 million acres, 5.4 million is in cropland, and in each given year, about 500,000 of that 5.4 million is in fallow rotation, in other words, not being farmed that year. 9 million acres of the 17 million is in pasture land and rangeland. Woodlands comprise 2.1 million acres, and then conservation dedicated land at about 500,000 acres. When we look at water, 44% of all Oregon farms do some irrigation. 64.5% of harvested cropland acres are irrigated, but the most important bullet, I believe, is this last bullet. Irrigated farms produce over 80% of the total value of Oregon's harvested crops. So again, we have to have water for agriculture in this state to be productive. Here's another interesting trend line in terms of irrigated land. You've seen some interesting blips, which probably equate to a number of things. Could be drought years, could be a jump in electricity prices, so farmers look to alternatives for irrigation. But definitely the trend line in terms of numbers of acres that are irrigated is on a gradual incline. And then when we look at irrigation by county, maybe you can see why we have some challenges in Klamath County. It's the county with the number one amount of acres under irrigation. And again, looking at this slate, all of those counties located on the east side of the state.
Question? Your Grace, agriculture processing is in Multnomah and Marion County. Most irrigation occurs east of the mountains. What kind of products are being packaged in Multnomah and Marion County? Is this stuff grown locally in the Willamette Valley, or is it produce brought in from eastern Oregon? Is East Oregon, I mean, what I know of eastern Oregon is alfalfa and wheat. not a lot of row crops, but I may be wrong in that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, we have a huge number of irrigated vegetable and some fruit production in some centers in eastern Oregon around the Hermiston area. Watermelons, obviously Hermiston watermelons, very famous, but corn, beans, potatoes, you name it. And then over in the Treasure Valley area, Ontario, also lots of variety in terms of vegetable production. And then in Central Oregon, in the Madras area, there as well, specialty seed crops, another large commodity. In terms of processing in the state, there's processing in the Hermiston area as well. There is processing in Ontario. There is product that moves to the west side, and there are processors who bring in product not only from other places in the United States, but internationally as well. NORPAC would be an example, bringing in broccoli from Mexico, per se. So it truly is a mixture. That concludes the overview of the industry, and now we wanted to shift to the department, unless there's any other questions about the industry. We're doing pretty good with time, Mr. Siebert. The Oregon Department of Agriculture was created in 1931 by the Legislative Assembly, and next year will mark our 75th anniversary of the department, if, assuming we're still here. We have a... Sorry.
There's something I don't know.
Comments made.
I came 10 minutes late, but I know you guys got into that deeply already. Apologize, I'll never be late again. Eliminating departments while I'm gone.
We have a threefold mission statement, and this has been our mission statement for really quite a long time. First of all, to promote the economic development and expand market opportunities for the industry. Secondly, to ensure food safety and provide consumer protection. And finally, to protect the natural resource base for present and future generations and of farmers and ranchers. So we hear a lot now, the buzzword around sustainability. Our mission statement reflects sustainability, and it's been what we've operated along for many years now. The Department of Agriculture truly does touch all Oregonians, and in a minute we'll go through a few slides highlighting some of the things that we've worked on and accomplishments during this current biennium. But from the food we all consume, to the products and fuels we purchase every day, to the natural resources that surround us and the jobs and economy of our state, the Department of Agriculture and its programs are essential to commerce, food safety, economic development, and natural resource management. We're a fairly unique agency in that our mission statement charges us with both promoting and regulating the industry, and we sometimes get questions about how do you do that. And actually, we think this provides us with the kind of philosophical approach that is helpful and something that I think government should do more of, and that's understanding the needs of the industry and regulating it in a way that doesn't regulate it out of business but helps it be successful and continue to grow and operate. And I believe there's only one other state agency that I'm aware of that has kind of this dual mission statement, and that's the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. We are also very diverse in our agency, mirroring the industry. Within our three policy areas, we have 9 program divisions. We oversee 30 different chapters of the Oregon Revised Statutes. Arguably, no other state agency of comparable size has such a breadth of programmatic responsibilities. And here's a quick overview of that responsibility through an organizational chart. The governor appoints both the director as well as the State Board of Agriculture. I have a deputy director and 2 assistant directors. Deputy director oversees our food safety division, our plant division, animal health division, and administrative services. 1 assistant director oversees natural resources, pesticides, measurement standards, and commodity inspection, and the other, the Ag Development and Marketing Division. But really, our deputy and assistant directors and, frankly, the management of our agency, we try to interfold that full mission statement through all of the work that we do. So our economic development and marketing activities are not confined solely to our Ag Development and Marketing Division. We have other divisions that contribute to that work. Pesticides Division, where most people might think that's a regulatory division, really focuses in terms of natural resources and how we can help the industry, again, be economically viable. So in terms of our management team, we're really focused on trying to fold in our mission statement within all of the divisions and programs in the agency. So what I'd like to do is take a moment and have about 3 slides for each policy area and just give you examples of what we've done that fits into that policy area. In terms of economic development and marketing, during this current biennium. The first major shipment of Oregon Pinot Noir to China was made possible in large part to both our efforts as well as working with the wine industry. And frankly, the grass seed industry kind of opened the Chinese market door for us. We're also exploring the opportunity with nursery products into China and now Oregon wine. In working closely with the Agricultural Commodity Commissions and producer groups, the Department of Ag was very instrumental in the state's Brand Oregon efforts. And we started out, first of all, highlighting seafood under the Oregon Wild seafood campaign. And then last fall, we're participants in the Oregon Bounty campaign, which was Oregon wine, cheese, hazelnuts, and pears. And we are looking for other opportunities to market Oregon agricultural products under the Brand Oregon effort. In the area of certification, and you'll hear a lot more about this later, but we're really seeing certification explode in the marketplace. The Department of Agriculture led the nation in this current biennium in piloting and implementing a good agricultural practices and good handling practices certification program. And then the United States Department of Agriculture took this model and is now spreading it throughout the United States. But we really believe in the area of certification. This is an opportunity for Oregon to have a marketing edge both domestically and internationally. We work on price negotiations with the industry. There's statutory authority to do this. In the last 4 years, we've overseen price negotiations with perennial ryegrass growers and dealers, where the two sides come together and set the price for the grass seed between the producers and dealers. And then for 2 years now, we've done the same thing with seafood harvesters and processors. This provides antitrust protection and a unique format for industry collaboration on pricing agreements. And then we administered, from 2001 to 2004, a federal program, the Specialty Crop Grant Program, where Oregon received $3.2 million in federal funds. Through the Board of Agriculture, they were really key in making the decision to award this money in the form of grants to 54 Oregon producers and ag groups. As a result of these grant efforts, we saw $20 million in increased sales, $1.5 million in cost savings for the grant recipients, and these grants leveraged more than $5.2 million in matching investments from those who received the grants. Switching to food safety and consumer protection. It's the Department of Agriculture that inspects your fuel pumps, 28,000 fuel pumps throughout Oregon, to make sure that the gas that you receive is actually that which appears on the meter. The pump is correctly labeled for octane content, and the quality of the fuel is reliable. In our food safety program, we have inspectors that are out in the field daily, responsible for inspecting food processing facilities, food retailers, i.e. grocery stores, delis, warehouses, dairies, and others to make sure that our food supply is indeed safe. We've been working with our counterparts in state government as well as federal government to really take a close look at the food safety system, the U.S. domestic system, and looking at ways to prevent any kind of a bioterrorism event. Dealing with our food safety, and if that happened and something happened in Oregon, it would be our food safety division that would join in the response to dealing with such an event. Hopefully, we'll never have to deal with that. So far in this current biennium, we've responded to 416 complaints on food quality, foodborne illness, and food personnel practices. We've participated in recalls of cut melons dealing with listeria, sprouts that have had salmonella, and egg salad with salmonella. These are all things that you don't want to eat, trust me. And finally, we monitor food production and distribution in over 9,000 licensed establishments for compliance with food safety laws and regulations. Interestingly enough, our Measurement Standards Division is also a leader in the nation in some of the things that they're doing. We are only one of eight states that are authorized to perform evaluations of large capacity weighing devices, such as floor-mounted scales, livestock, hopper scales, etc. Most of these things you find in the ag industry, wood products, scales that big trucks drive onto. We do make sure that those scales are actually accurate. And we are only one of 9 states with a lab that's accredited to perform precision mass calibrations. So our lab actually helps Oregon's high-tech industry, for example, make sure that all of their calibrated stuff is performing accurately. We also calibrate the ping pong balls that are used in the Oregon lottery. And finally, in our natural resources area, during this current biennium, we finalized all of our agricultural water quality management plans in the 39 watersheds throughout the state. This has taken us 7 to 8 years, I believe, to complete all of the plans. And now we are switching into full gear in terms of actually implementing those plans on the ground and really helping our producers maximize their operations to minimize impacts on water quality under Senate Bill 1010. We also run the confined animal feeding operation, or the CAFO program, and the animal feeding operation in the livestock industry. In our plant division, we have ongoing surveillance and eradication efforts of bad bugs and diseases. These are things that can be devastating to the industry. Some of you may remember the gypsy moth outbreak in Eugene some 20 years ago, where basically the bug got out of control and we had severe economic damage in our wood products industry. We're trying to keep that from happening in terms of our monitoring of pests and disease. So we continue to trap for gypsy moths, Japanese beetles, other bugs. We've spent a lot of time this interim, and you've probably heard, dealing with sudden oak death, which is a disease in our nursery industry and has the potential to, again, be economically devastating, and other noxious weeds that we basically want to keep out of Oregon. It's a lot easier to keep them out or eradicate them quickly than let them become infested and try to deal with them.
Sudden oak that's down in my country, I saw the map. Is there anything outside satellite places you've had problems outside of that area?
Mr. Chairman, in your part of the state is the only area where we've got the disease out in the natural environment, and we feel like we've got a pretty good delineation line around that. We may have had a pocket or two that spread out this year that we've adjusted our line a little bit, but we are seeing success in terms of eradicating that disease in the wild down in Curry County. The other places where we've had sudden oak death disease has been in nurseries, and we've had to deal with a number of nurseries go in and kill plant material, incinerate it to
burning normally the way? Or
yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
I'd imagine there's stuff out there that isn't here that we don't want to come here. Do you have the resources, or are you already working on that to prevent anything that we don't want here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, we'll get into this discussion a little bit on a performance measure that we have, but basically there's an invasive species council that gets together and identifies bad bugs and diseases that we don't want in the state, and there's probably over 100 different kinds of bugs and diseases on that list. We obviously don't have the resources for all of those, so we really try to prioritize, and our goal is to keep the top 10 worst bugs and diseases out of the state. But certainly, you know, if sudden oak death was not on the list 3 years ago, it didn't exist, and it's something new that was found and quickly jumped up to the top of that list, so we take the resources that we have and use it to work on keeping that disease out.
Yeah, just a couple of questions, and then you may hear this sort of as a chronic theme coming from me. As we look at these different agency budgets, that's just not natural resources, but in DHS and education, I constantly see outliers that strikes me as strange that we've got two agencies working on the same types of problems. I wonder what the interaction is. And food safety, I think of public health. And they play a major role. You play a major role. And I'm just sort of curious where those two intercede at. You must have some cooperation amongst you. And it always leads in my mind to the discussion, who's where and when and why. I mean, you know, this doesn't make any sense to me. You're doing this and they're doing this. And I know the different agencies. So what's your interaction like with them on food safety?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, the Health Division does food safety inspections in restaurants. So that's the delineating line. They handle places where food is eaten on premises, and we handle places where it's sold and consumers take it home or in food processing facilities. So if you have the crossover might be a place where you've got a small grocery store that has a deli in it, and if the deli sales are higher than the grocery sales, then the health division handles those inspections. If the grocery sales are higher than the deli sales, then we handle the inspections. So you do not have inspectors from both the health division and our agency in the same facility. We communicate and clearly identify those facilities that we take care of and the facilities that they take care of. In the health division, they're a little bit different in that some counties, the health division contracts with the counties to actually perform those inspections. So they've got kind of a separate arrangement in some places. For the facilities that we inspect all of them throughout the state.
I assume in your performance measures, we'll have a better look at that as we go through. I imagine you have performance measures specifically for this.
Mr. Chairman, we can discuss that. Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Okay. In the natural resources area, I think all of you were aware of the single case of BSC, the cow that was found in Washington State in December of 2003, the cow affectionately known as the cow that stole Christmas. And we were involved in that effort in that some of the trace forwards from that single cow did come to Oregon. And one of our biggest dairies, which is in the Boardman area, we inventoried about 36,000 cows in that dairy in the time span of about a week. So it was a very aggressive effort by us. We pulled in a number of our livestock brand inspectors from around the state and quickly moved through and took an inventory of that dairy. And we did also a couple of other small dairies in Oregon as a result of that single incident. We are now working with the industry and the U.S. Department of Agriculture in implementing the National Livestock Identification Program, which is its goal is to identify and be able to trace every single cow in the United States. And basically, if we need to find a cow, the goal is to be able to find that cow in 48 hours. We're just now registering livestock premises, and then the next step will be actual individual cows.
It seems like that would be almost impossible. You can only do that on an automobile. You've got a title and everything.
Mr. Chair, we think we have the technology. I think there is definitely some question around logistics, and we're just going along and seeing how it all works out.
As I used to raise cattle, I could tell you there were times that I couldn't find my cows in 48 hours. Okay,
they're on the neighbor's place.
They're on the neighbor's place. And I'd leave them there for a while if nobody complained. You know, I'm getting their grass and mine. But a lot of these cattle are free-ranging. I mean, there's no way you can find them in 48 hours.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, maybe at least you would know the premises that they're on, and then to be able to actually go out and find the cow would be the next challenge.
5 mile radius, I can go.
There you go.
It's
a weak one. The walls will leave anyway.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, that's one of the challenges that we're finding because you have different dynamics. Let's say in the Midwest, in terms of how livestock is handled versus in some of the western states where you do have cattle that range on thousands of acres and. And rounding them up is, as you well know, a multiple-day effort. And finally, the Department of Agriculture leads the nation in implementing biological control of noxious weeds. We've identified 71 different agents that we have introduced. So these could be bugs that eat good bugs that eat bad weeds to control 33 weed species in another area that we're continuing to hope for new biological agents to be introduced.
Anything with the gorse? Bannon, I know you had a little looking bug that made cobwebs or something. Anything happen there?
Mr. Chair, we'll go back and talk to our bug experts and come back tomorrow and see if we've had success with that. We also get involved in farmland protection and obviously watching very closely Measure 37. But as an example of the kind of work we do, we received a request from Metro when they were going through their latest round of analyzing the expansion of their urban growth boundary. We pulled together interests in the agricultural industry and provided recommendations to Metro as they considered where to actually expand the boundary, and those would be recommendations that would minimize that expansion's effects on agriculture. And finally, good timing, Representative Krupp. The Department of Agriculture is very, very involved in the renewable energy effort. Obviously, biodiesel has been a topic that's been front of mind here lately, but we have success stories in a number of areas. Wind generation in eastern Oregon, methane digesters on dairies. The chairman of our board has been instrumental in developing a methane digester on his dairy. Looking at opportunities for micro hydro projects in irrigation systems to generate electricity. A lot of renewable energy kinds of things happen on farms or with farm production, and so this is an area that we've spent a lot of time, we expect we'll be spending a lot of time, and we think has some real opportunity for the agricultural industry.
Chair, thank you. Seeing as diesel hit 267 in Medford over the weekend, where are you actually at in biofuels? We have a situation where through the Grange we're trying to buy biodiesel now. Mm-hmm. They're having a hard time mm-hmm. obtaining that. Where are we as far as biodiesel is concerned?
Mr. Chairman, the challenge that we have right now, it's, you know, I hate to use the old saying, but the chicken and the egg. What comes first, the production of the biomass that can then be crushed and turned into biodiesel, or do you want a biodiesel facility and then you do the production? We're kind of trying to do both things as close to simultaneously as we can. We've worked with the Department of Energy and Economic and Community Development Department, and we have some interested parties looking at Oregon to actually site a biodiesel facility. That would be great to have here, obviously, or even in surrounding states, but ideally in Oregon, so we're active in those conversations. And at the same time, with the industry in saying, okay, if there was a facility here that could buy your product, are we up and ready to go with actually producing that product? And there are a few hitches in that as well. We won't go into detail here, but those are kind of simultaneous things happen that we'd like to have happen and get online so that Oregon is taking advantage of what we think will be a growing demand for biodiesel.
Chair?
Yes.
I'm not sure I understood what you told me just
now. Okay.
Okay? I mean, the problem is developing a market and developing the product at the same time, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm well aware of that. What I want to know is what actually has been done to this point. You know, my point being, a lot of people would like to buy biodiesel. It's not available. Diesel in Medford is $2.67 a gallon. The price I heard was about $3 a gallon for biodiesel. I think a lot of people at this point are ready to jump. Where are we actually as far as producing a plant, using organ products to produce biodiesel, mixture of diesel and agricultural products? Where are we actually? Are we anywhere more than just talking about it? If we are, that's okay, but I just want to know where we're at.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I see we've had a switch here. We actually have an expert who probably knows more than I do, and why don't I turn the microphone over to Brent Searle, who is a special assistant to the director and has been carrying the renewable energy load for the agency, and he can answer your question, hopefully, or Representative Krupp can.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, short answer, I think we're probably a couple months away from some low-volume production on yellow grease, spent cooking grease. There's a couple businesses in the Portland metro area that are pretty close there. That could be up to a million gallons a year within 6 months. On the oil seed side,
for the record,
I'm sorry,
name,
yes, Brent Searle with the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Thank you.
On the oil seed side, there are some companies that are, as we speak, talking with growers about contracts and getting ready to build facilities. We're probably, in reality, a year away from actually seeing some oil turned out from plants here in the state.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Getting closer.
Thanks. Most are kind of excited about this.
There actually are several grower groups that are coming together to pool their resources to site biodiesel processing facilities. And it seems to be gaining a kind of a life of its own and a momentum. And the director is right. We do have some small challenges here and there that we need to overcome, especially in the biodiesel area, relating to something we can talk about later, relating to disease issues that are transferable from one type of a canola plant to other types of row crops that we grow here, losing some of the tools to that effect. There was an article in the Capital Press just this last week about losing Ronalyn in beans, and that helps control white mold, which is one of the crossover diseases between growing canola for oil seeds. So we have some other issues, and we're actually pretty confident we can work through those, and we're beginning that process of making that happen. Nothing is ever simple in this process.
No. It wasn't been done already.
That's right. Please, Representative Shofford, you're good to go. Okay, please continue. Thanks.
Okay, we've got a couple of slides just giving a budget overview, and then we're going to dive into performance measures. Real quickly, the top row gives you the 2003-2005 legislatively adopted budget for the agency, so you can see the general fund, lottery fund, most of that is in Measure 66 dollars, other funds, which are license fees for services we provide, a little bit of federal funds, total budget, positions, and FTE. Then you can see the percentage breakdown by fund source. And then you can compare that to the 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget. And you'll see some increase in general fund. Lottery fund is actually a decrease there, a decrease in other funds, federal funds about the same, and the total budget about the same. And obviously we'll get into a lot of detail on that in a different phase.
Where do you use them in the budget?
Where in the budget?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, in our soil and water districts receive some Measure 66 dollars for projects on the ground. In our plant program, when we actually do eradication efforts, we can use Measure 66 dollars for those projects. We can't use Measure 66 to do the survey work. In our Natural Resources Division, some of our Senate Bill 1010 work is from Measure 66 dollars. And in our weeds program, again, eradicating weeds around the state, we use Measure 66 dollars.
The jump in general funds, does that reflect some proposed hikes in fees? Or is that a reflection there or what?
The general fund, it would not be fees. Fees are in other funds. So general fund, the increases there are some of the Measure 66 programs. This biennium reverted back to general fund. And then we've got some budget packages with general fund in them as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have answered the question that I wanted to ask already. You've flip-flopped general funds and other funds in the last biennium in order to maintain your budget, and flipped them back again this time, with other funds down and general fund back up again. Is that 66 funds being moved?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, actually it's in the lottery fund column that the Measure 66 dollars would be reflected. Paul's killing me. In the other funds column, that reflects when you have other funds, you get limitation to spend it, and we don't always get the cash level in at the limitation level. So this reduction there actually represents a decrease in limitation, but we don't expect it to be a decrease in actual program.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, also part of the switching out of general fund and other funds occurred in 2003-2005 using Pacific Coastal SEM recovery monies that come into the state as federal funds and get transferred from Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to the agency as other funds, and that's one of the reasons why the other funds also went down, including some of the reduction in limitation.
So that's been moved back in the direction.
Back to general fund. That's correct, sir.
I'll trace that with you later. Okay.
And here's a quick slide just so you can see where the staff is in our agency. Our largest division is our commodity inspection division in terms of position numbers, but those often will be seasonal positions. Then our plant division, our animal health and identification division, and then smaller numbers in the rest of the divisions in the agency. So, deep breath. We're going to shift to performance measures. And this has the potential to get very confusing. So, if I could, I'd like to try to keep your attention on the slide on the screen, because we're not going to go in the same order on the screen as the order of your measures in your book. And we're doing this for a perfectly logical reason.
But you're trying to confuse us.
We are trying to confuse you. Confuse you. We have currently 26 performance measures in our agency. We have a number of them that we are proposing to modify. We have a number of them that we're proposing to eliminate. We have a few new ones that we want to bring on. So we were trying to sort through the best way to do this without losing you. So we're going to go through in a minute and focus first on the performance measures that we're keeping, just all the ones that we propose to keep as they are, then the ones that we want to keep with a little bit of modification, and then the new ones that we want to add. So at the end of that presentation, you would have the measures that we would propose to have in place going forward. And it would be about 16 measures. So we would propose to go from 26 measures down to 16. Then we're going to go through the measures that we're proposing to delete or to move to internal measures only. So we're trying to figure out a way to do this so we just didn't completely confuse you, and hopefully this will work. And in a minute, I'm going to turn it over to Lisa to go through each measure in detail, but I wanted to just talk a little bit about how we use performance measures in the agency. We believe that they are definitely a tool to assist in managing the agency. They aren't the only tool that we use, but they are certainly a tool that we use. They are definitely designed for continuous improvement. We don't get it right all the time, and you will see some measures that we just completely messed up on and were the wrong measures, and we need to get rid of them. We believe that measures should definitely be meaningful to the organization and its clients and customers. And most of our measures are definitely high level. We have many measures within programs that count numbers of things, but we're trying to keep our performance measures at that true outcome level. Let's see, the next slide I think kind of summarizes what I mentioned. I think I said 26. I guess we have 25 measures now. We plan to keep some as primary measures. We plan to move some back into the agency and only use within the agency. And our goal would be to end up with 15 new measures that we would have you approve moving forward from here if you agree with our synopsis.
Are any of the ones, are any of the ones you're going to get rid of only been like a year or 2 years?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. Chair, Representative Krieger, there are some of the measures that we are proposing to make secondary that we adopted last biennium. We have a couple of years of data behind them, but we have recognized as we've tried to work through this process that we have too many measures, one, and they tend to be more output or counting-oriented measures that we think would be better served to keep those as internal measures rather than externally reported.
Okay. Very good. Anything else?
I get mixed up who's chair here.
Some days so do I. Please continue.
So we're going to dive in.
So this is performance measure number 3. And again, we tried to put these in an order that we thought was more logical. So all of the performance measures that we're proposing to keep, we're going to go through first. This performance measure looks at the percentage of motor fuel samples that are found in compliance with the posted octane levels. Several biennia ago, when this program was instituted, we did a background study and estimated that about 3% of the gasoline sold in Oregon was sold below the posted octane level. So we set this target by trying to basically cut that in half. Any questions?
Chair?
Yes.
How often do you actually inspect individual gas stations? How many inspectors do you have out in the world?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we try to look at all of the pumps once annually. We have also done some changing of our frequencies based on performance. So those businesses that are continue to perform well, we may see them a little less often, and our poorer performers will see us on a more frequent basis.
Representative.
You've got one that two or three occasions they fuel hasn't been like it's supposed to. What do you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, we have the ability to stop those pumps from being used. We can put them out of service. And there are other regulatory actions that we can take. We have citation power within the agency as well.
Sure.
Okay, that's the authority you have. But do you exercise it routinely that within the industry they know if fuel isn't to a certain standard that it's severe enough that, you know, it doesn't play the game?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, typically by working with the companies or facilities, we can bring them back into compliance. And it's rare that we have used the citation authority. But we have put them out of foot stop sales on them if they continue to be out of compliance.
Hello?
You're talking like, for instance, octane rating. Or it's 10 cents a gallon. And or more, just on one, you know, from super down to the medium grade, it wouldn't take too many gallons, make a lot of money. And it would seem like if you had someone you've had more than once, there ought to be enough of a severe penalty that it would not occur again. Can you say that that's happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it kind of gets back to the philosophy of how we regulate the industry, and our goal is to bring people into compliance as quickly as possible and keep them in operation. I don't think the industry, let me put it this way, I believe the industry would know that we would put a pump out of service if they wouldn't work with us, and we're not afraid to do that. Our first attempt is really to work with them and say, you need to be in compliance. We're going to do everything we can to get you there, but if we have someone who isn't going to cooperate, we will put them on a stop sale. And I think our performance measures in this area, frankly, show that the industry takes us seriously because they are consistently, you know, since 99, they've been above 98% in terms of compliance.
Bad players.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Senator.
Yeah. Which one?
Senator Shields first, Senator Bates second. My apologies.
Senator first.
Well, I was just going to ask one more, shall we say, fuelish question. And that is kind of prompted by Representative Krieger, and that would be, how do we compare with other states with regard to this level of compliance?
Good question.
Representative Krieger, we know that in states where they don't have motor fuel quality programs, the motor fuel tends to be below standards. In comparing us to other states, I would need to go back to our staff and ask them for some ranking to see exactly where we are.
We can do that.
And we'll be happy to do it.
Okay, Senator Bates.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is sort of a rhetorical question, but correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to make an assumption that you don't announce your visits ahead of time. This is unannounced how are you doing the day visits. What about looking for contamination in fuel? It's been a real problem in a few places I know in the past, and we talked about it two sessions ago, and that fuel would have, that pump would have contamination in it, it could plug engines and cause problems. Do you guys check for that at all, or is it just checking for octane ratings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, are you referring to water in the fuel?
Water or other contaminants.
Looking for water in the fuel, that would be part of the motor fuel quality program.
That's something you do.
Yes, it is.
You look for other follow-up?
Yes.
You do other contaminants also?
And again, I would need to go back and check with staff. Water is the one that I'm most familiar with, but I'll be happy to ask, and we'll get back to you with that.
Thank you.
And in that regard, are you finding that there are, I mean, occasionally we will hear stories about gas stations that will get a load of gas in and they'll cut it to some extent. Do you find that very often? And what do you do when you do find that they've put extenders in the fuel, shall we say, that really lower the octane rating and cause that fuel to work more poorly?
And again, that would be a question that I need to go back and ask our technical staff about.
It actually came up in a conversation we had the other day regarding biofuels with a number of individuals, and it seems that is a practice that has occurred in times past. I'm just curious. It may, moving to a biofuels type of a footing, for less than a proper term, but may perhaps increase opportunities for that to occur. And we would want to make sure that we assure the content. One of our primary concerns, as you know, is we have new engine standards for diesel trucks that will be here 2007, I think. And one of the things that they're concerned about in terms of biofuels being, biodiesel specifically, is that the biodiesel is produced to ASTM standards. In other words, the engine manufacturers are not interested in warranting their new engines if a company is putting fuel in that's substandard. So we want to be really careful that you guys are on the right path to probably have to ramp up to some extent to make sure that that's assured, because you're going to have grower-owned cooperatives out there that are going to be processing biodiesel, some homegrown stills, for lack of a better term. it really isn't a still, but at any rate, we need to. You're going to be more challenged than you have in times past to be able to meet that demand. How will you do that?
Mr. Chair, we are aware of that, and we've had discussions with Department of Energy because we would be taking care of the quality side in terms of biodiesel. This program is completely funded with fees for service. And so we would need to set up a licensing mechanism and come in and inspect and license, and the fees for that license would need to pay for the program. There might be a question about initiating the program, whether you've got enough money from license fees to pay for that, and there may need to be some kind of additional funding, at least at first, to get the program up and running.
Okay.
Okay, ready for next measure?
Please.
Performance measure number 7. This measure looks at the top 10 plant pest diseases and weed species successfully excluded from Oregon each year. And this gets to what Director Koba referred to previously. There is a list of 100 invaders that's put out by the Invasive Species Council, and we have chose to target the top 10 that the agency has impact and influence on in terms of trying to keep them excluded from our state.
And I might add that, you know, you look at this and you think, you've picked 10, you're at 10, what is this really telling us? And we've kind of noodled around a little bit if there's a different way to portray this measure. Certainly if anyone has any good ideas, if this number dropped to 9 in any of these years, that would be a very big deal to us. If we couldn't keep the top 10 out or under control, we would think we would have a very big problem in our program. But there are other bad things out there. There are other bad bugs and diseases that are in Oregon that we work to try to control. But our goal is to keep the top 10 out.
In addition, this performance measure directly links to benchmark 89.
Senator Bates and then Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you probably work with a large number of pests and weeds that you're trying to exclude or keep under control in Oregon. How big is that universe? How many species are you dealing with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, like I said, this Invasive Weeds Council, which is made up of folks from our agency, probably forestry, OSU, there are county weed control districts that are represented. They have a list of 100 that they're keeping an eye on. I'm sure there's more than even that. And I would say that this is an area, as we've seen with the increase in global commerce, that will continue to be an area of concern for us, both in terms of plant as well as in a minute we'll have a measure around animal health diseases. I would expect the pressure here to remain and to grow, and it's just something we're going to have to keep an eye on in terms of what kinds of bad things are around that can be detrimental to not just the industry but to people that have yards or what have you. So it's more than 100. There are bad things that are established in Oregon that we, you know, where we have biological controls that we're trying to send out to try to treat them that way and actually reduce, if not eliminate, those populations. There's a lot of them, and frankly, we don't have the resources to deal with all of them.
Interestingly enough, Senator, I chaired a work group on the invasive weed species that was a very, very, very broad section of people. And what we've discovered is that the federal government has set aside as a category of spending quite a bit of money actually for the states, but it's not been funded. And given the deficit that is being run on the national level, it may not happen. And that would be very helpful. We have a lot of weed control boards across the state, as you know. Yeah. And they also are lacking for resources. There are a couple of small pieces of legislation that came out of our little work group. One of them is boat trailers that back into the lake. Yeah. They come out with algae and weeds on them, and people are frankly not very responsible about taking that off and leaving it there. They go down the road with it, and that gets spread all over God's good green earth. And so we have a piece of legislation to deal with that. Recognizing that one of the biggest sources of contaminated invasive weed species come off of containers. And that is a much more difficult issue to get our arms around. Some of it comes in by the air, air shipment, air cargo. But by and large, it is a very, very difficult thing for us to get our arms around, and we need to desperately. It causes us well over $100 million a year in lost revenue to business in Oregon because of invasive weed species issues. And it is something we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to in the coming years. I don't know how we get it paid for, though. Yes, sir.
I appreciate your knowledge of the area. I have a less than great knowledge of this, but everything from whirling disease and rainbow trout, from fisherman's boots from Montana to Idaho to Oregon and vice versa, and the amount of exotic plants being brought into people's homes and through nursery associations, and we live in a worldwide economy now. This is a major issue for all parts of the world, really. So what I was trying to get to here was you're trying to find a better performance measure for this, which I agree the one you have is not really adequate. Being 100% of the top 10 really doesn't tell us anything. You might want to consider where you are in the 100 pests that are being identified by the board, knowing that's not the whole universe, but at least it's the one you have some ability to measure and look at. And you might want to develop a bell-shaped curve saying, this is where we're at. Are we falling behind? Are we moving forward? And then make it very clear that people are looking at futures. If you do develop that kind of a measuring tool, we have very limited resources, but we feel we must report to you that this is not a failure of the agency. This is a serious problem we're not dealing with. There's a difference there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, you are very correct in looking at that top 100 list. There are many of the species on there that are terrestrial species that the agency doesn't work with. Mitten crabs would be an example that other agencies within state government have an input. So when we expand it to something bigger, the agency loses some of its c- control over the measure or the performance, because we don't have the ability to monitor everything.
Mr. Chair, sure. I would suggest you might want to go to that kind of performance measure also as an informative tool and explain to future committees we do not have control over this. Okay. And that's what terrestrial species, eh? That begs the obvious question, are you dealing with extraterrestrial species too? One would hope not, okay?
Senator Shields, and then Representative Shaw.
Well, I guess I'm reflecting somewhat Senator Bates' concern, because I look at this and I see you doing 10 out of 10 in terms of the top 10 plant pests successfully excluded, but I don't know anything in terms of were these 10 excluded 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and you've just been keeping them out for 20 years? Are they ones that you're really having to do anything about? I mean, we've got a whole lot of species that we see all the time and we run into, and we don't see much progress being made on those. And so it doesn't tell me a lot. And I'm trying to, I don't know what these 10 are. Maybe you'd like to tell us what they are, and if it's kudzu, maybe it's just in the south, you know, or something. I don't know what they are. I don't know how to get your hands around it, but.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the 10 that are on the list are ones that we don't want established in Oregon. And I can give you three that I know of for sure. Gypsy moth is one, Japanese beetle is one, and sudden oak death. So, as I said, if we could keep this chart looking like this for 20 years, we would view that as a success. I would agree with you, this is not as informative as it should be. So I think we will go back and kind of try to fiddle around with what we think might be a good replacement there and have that ready to bring back to you when we come before you again.
Thank you, complaint. Thank you.
Oh, good observation, Senator. And it is another important measure would be how you're able to deal with the species that are here that are causing certain issues, which is another one that's coming. Representative Shoffler.
My wife would testify that invasives, I'm not making much progress on invasive species on my yard, but anyway. what are our efforts in this and in dealing with the invasive species that are here? I'd like to see what our efforts compared to other states are, and successes. If you have that laying around, don't go in a lot of trouble. And then also our country, the United States, relative to the rest of the world and our efforts. I'd like to see some kind of comparison, if you have it handy, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shaw, I can give you an example of what we do with gypsy moth. Every year we go set out traps around in the woods, in backyards, and those kinds of things, and we catch moths. And if we catch multiple moths in a given area, and we say, we may have a problem here, we then actually do a spray program to spray when those moths, you know, come out and kill them. And then we set traps again the following year to make sure we've got them. And we're down to the point now where we usually have a spray project for gypsy moth every year, maybe a couple. But in any given year or in 2 years, we're able to eradicate it so it doesn't become established. And that's what we're doing on that side of things, to keep these things out. Sudden oak death, I can give you other examples. And we're going to get to a measure, the next measure here in a minute, which is what we're trying to do to deal with things that are established and either keep them under control or reduce their establishment. And we'll go back and see what we've got in terms of comparison with other states and internationally. The hot thing in the U.S. right now is the introduction of soybean rust came in on the hurricanes. And it's moving south to north, and it has implications. We don't grow soybeans in Oregon, but it is a disease that it can affect other crops, and it's a big, big deal.
So please continue. Move to the next one. Thank you.
Performance measure number 8. We would propose to keep this one as well. This measure looks at the percent of Oregon counties with target pests and weeds present where biological control agents are established. And so this measures how we're doing in terms of putting out biological controls to take care of insect, pests, and weed species.
Lisa, that's quite a jump from 03 to 04 in terms of percentage. I think it's about 4%. Why are you jumping up that 4% and then maintaining it consistently out through 2007?
Mr. Chair, as I asked staff about this performance measure as well, they said that they put what they thought was their best science and aggressive targets in place. And so this was the best they could do in terms of putting an aggressive target based on the experience that they had.
Okay, so why does it stay static then? Would it not increase, or do we not have enough counties to increase that number to even higher than 29%?
Mr. Chair, this is still a relatively new program, and there is a lot of exploratory work going on in this area, and so just the initial getting started and getting going and building up to find new predator pests that would feed on them is part of the science. It's a developing science.
Okay. Yes, Senator.
Chair, I appreciate that you're measuring a percentage of counties trying to use biological methods of controlling pests. It kind of goes into another theme here quite a bit. We want, well, at least many of us are looking for outcomes more than measurements. This is not really an outcome here would be of the 30% of counties using this. The results were the following as far as how effective the program was concerned. That's the kind of information we're kind of looking for here. Just that you got a certain number of counties complying doesn't mean it's an effective program that it works. I'm hoping it does, for obvious reasons. But I would echo number one, the chair. The measure shouldn't be 30%; it should be 100%. But the real question should be, does it work? If it works, we should go to 100% as quickly as possible and not use chemicals and other methods that a lot of people have concerns about. So to me, this really isn't. It's a measure, but it's not really an outcome. An outcome is it working or not? What's the effect of what you're doing, not just that you have a certain percentage of counties involved in this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, and I think some folks that reviewed this measure beforehand had the same comment. So, again, I would agree with you 100%, and let us go back and, again, try to noodle around. I think part of the issue here is counties... You know, counties vary in terms of their program and how well-funded they are and their ability to even establish a biological control that we know would be effective. We've had some great success with biological controls, and I think you're right. If we could think about a way to show what we know is working in terms of reducing or eliminating a bad thing as opposed to just getting it out there, that may be more meaningful. So let us go back and see what we've got and can rework on this one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What time to look up a change, is that? Like tag team wrestling.
On to the next. Performance measure number 11 looks at the percentage of pesticide investigations that result in enforcement action. And this measure, we believe, measures the effectiveness of education and outreach over time, because what we've seen is more of our pesticide investigations, as we've done more outreach, less and less of them are resulting in actual enforcement actions. There is likely not a violation of the law,
and we think that's a good thing.
President Schaffer,
give me an example of why you'd have an investigation and then exactly what you'd have to enforce and what brought that enforcement about. And the action you take on the perpetrator or the violator or whatever. Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, an example would be we would receive a complaint about a commercial pesticide application where someone would say the product used wasn't effective. And we would go out and look to see if there was actual action from the pesticide. Another example, a complaint that product had drifted from one field to another. And we go out and we sample and swab and run tests to see if there is actual drift there. If we find that drift has occurred in a situation, then we can issue a civil penalty against the applicator.
Yes.
I'm interested in the it not being effective. Who would, I mean, I can imagine the applicator could complain about that, but if you want to touch on that. But the how many complaints do you get? How many do you investigate? And then how many are there some kind of enforcement action taken? Do you have those top of your head?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't have those numbers at the top of my head, but I can easily go back and we can bring those back for you.
How many you get, how many out of those you investigate, then how many enforcement actions are actually meted out?
So the number of complaints.
Number of complaints, how many you determine are worthy of investigation, and then of those that you do investigate, how many enforcement actions, how many folks do you fine or whatever it is you do to them, please.
We'll be happy to bring that back.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
And what's your last point?
Can you break it down on where this goes on to? Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'll have to look into that. I know that we have the numbers. I don't know how it's sorted out by locations.
How close to the comp farm?
I certainly hope not. Okay, Senator Nelson and Senator Bates.
Good representative asked my questions.
Oh, okay.
Number of complaints.
Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just trying to get a handle on this, and I apologize to other members of the committee if I'm asking questions that you know the answers to, but I don't. If I please feel free.
Senator,
it's
absolutely fine. Get it on record and get your questions answered.
Your method of measuring compliance for pesticide use, and let's say herbicide use too, is it primarily based on getting complaints in? Do you have field agents that go out and monitor as people are applying pesticides or herbicides? What is sort of your system for having some idea what's going on out there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we have investigators that will go out and respond to complaints. We also do observations of pesticide applications if we know that there is a situation where people have had problems in the past. We'll go out and do observations with producers making pesticide applications. We also do monitoring of pesticide records for record keeping compliance as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, when I see a decline like this in the amount of cases that are, I guess, better word, prosecuted or fine levied, there could be a couple of reasons for that. One is that people are being more careful and we're having less complaints and people are more aware of it, which I hope is the answer, or that the agency is not enforcing as heavily as before, and it's going the other direction. I mean, there's no way to look at this and tell me what it is, so I have to rely on you to say to me, you know, it's going the right direction, things are looking pretty good, or, you know, we've got a problem, we just can't get everybody out there in time, and we've got a lot of, you know, we got a backlog of complaints we haven't investigated, and give me some feel for what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I think we can bring you maybe even history on complaint numbers to give you a sense of that. That, you know, that's the balance between outcomes-based performance measures versus just showing the numbers. And certainly, we can bring those back and share that information with you. I can tell you again, our agency's philosophy, first of all, is to work with the industry to keep them in compliance. But at the same time, particularly when it comes to pesticides, it's a very can be a controversial issue, and we believe it's in our best interest to make sure we are doing a good job in dealing with the industry, and if we have problems in making sure we're being aggressive against those problems, because if we have people that aren't doing things right and we're not taking care of it, it's not helping the 99% of the industry that is doing things right. So I think that's the best answer that I can give you in terms of where we are philosophically, but I think there's no secret that pesticides and pesticide use is a topic that's of great interest to people, and we take the work we do very seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
Just follow up to that. I mean, most of the pesticide applicators have to take an exam. It's a tough exam, too. I took one years and years ago, and then when I was supposed to renew it, I said, I'll just hire somebody else to do this for me. But the farmers, I think, are getting much more educated on how to do things. And,
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I might add that we are seeing that trend. We also license all applicators. So if you want to apply a pesticide, you need to come to us and get licensed. And I think there are farmers who have gone this route to just say, you know, it's in order for me to take the time and come in and get tested, that's not something I'm going to choose to do. I will let a professional applicator take care of that. They handle the product. They know the label. They know what they're doing with it, and given the amount of time that it takes me, maybe even once a year to get up to speed, it's not worth it. And so we are seeing that trend a bit in that way in terms of professional applicators.
It's a serious problem for some of us.
Reason both of us should be doing.
And the other issue I just want to get on the record is pesticides are expensive, and if you can't use them, most farmers won't. They use that as a last resort because of the cost of applying a pesticide on, in Eastern Oregon, thousands of acres. It's not cheap.
Yes, sir, thanks.
Well, the other area I'm concerned about, I hear a lot of anecdotal discussion about, is what the small 10, 15-acre people are doing and what people are doing around their private homes. And I sometimes worry about that more than I do the big farmers. I'm fairly convinced the big farmers do a pretty good job. I'm not real concerned. I know others are, but I share some real concern about the small people, small farmers, which have a significant amount of acres in this country, this state, and what people use in their homes. Is there any controls or discussions about that at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'm going to take a stab at this.
Okay. I may be incorrect.
Pesticides, I think of them in two classifications: restricted use, which are the most toxic pesticides, and then general use pesticides, which are, I tend to refer to those as over-the-counter ones. Those are the ones that you can buy at Bi-Mart, Home Depot, Lowe's. If you are going to use the most toxic pesticides, the restricted use, you have to be licensed, whether you are a 5-acre farmer or a 500-acre farmer, because you have to show the license to be able to purchase the product.
Thank you.
But Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I mean, we are aware of instances. I'm aware of a personal instance where you're right. The homeowner goes and buys Roundup or something else, maybe doesn't read the label as carefully as they should. We try to do outreach in terms of our mantra in the pesticides division is read the label. Read the label, read the label, and apply according to the label. But I think there are people, and you and I may be some of them, well, if 1 ounce is good, 2 ounces is going to be better. And I really want to kill these weeds the first time and not have to go back a second time. And we know there are problems like that. We don't have, frankly, the resource to get out and do a lot of that. Sometimes those things are happening.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
I just feel that sometimes, and to be honest about that, the people who are making a living at farming get hammered by this stuff pretty hard, and I'm not saying I wouldn't want to continue what we're doing and maybe even increase what we're doing, but some of the people criticizing the most in their own homes are just as bad, and it's sort of pointing a finger at other people. I mean, an instance I had recently in my area, one of our neighbors decided to use a product called Crossbow, which, if you read the label on that, that'll set you back a couple steps. Decided to spray the entire row, which included 5 other 10-acre farms and 2 houses. Didn't tell anybody one Sunday morning, and we found out when we smelled something funny in our kitchen. And that's the kind of stuff that I think puts people on edge, but also points out there's another problem here. And just continuing to blame people who are really making a living at farming at this is not appropriate or fair. enough said. Thank you.
Thank you. And from a farmer's perspective, I will share with you that we, by and large, live in mortal fear of incorrectly applying our herbicides, not only from the respect of the bureaucratic fine structure that's available both at the federal level and through the ODA, but also from legal liability now. Issues just as you just described are really the issues that are driving this more than anything. It's our insurance carriers now, liability insurance. If you don't use the product in accordance with the label, your insurance carrier may not defend you in a court action. And it's getting more and more so that the economic issues are driving the process. But the level of training we have to have, and I say we because I have just recently let my restricted use private applicator's license expire, does involve a lot of math now. And it's become a harder test than it used to be when I first got my applicator's license 20 years ago. And so the level of training and performance is there, and of course our record-keeping requirements now on the federal level are you have to notate everything that you do, and should EPA come knocking on your doors, you better have complete records because you'll be in sad shape. So believe me, we take it very, very seriously, and the director is right. Chemicals these days are so darned expensive that if we can get by without using them, we won't. I mean, we just won't make the choice to use them for a host of reasons. And the other thing is that it's driving a new industry of integrated pest management and trying to find natural ways to control certain problems. And probably one of the greatest success stories we've had in Oregon is the cinnabar moth. You know, for tansy ragwort and for groundsel, you see those little moths with the red and black wings flying around in the spring, and the next thing you know, those little orange and black OSU caterpillars are up there eating on the and they'll take a field of tansy or a field of groundsel and they'll just decimate, and they don't cause problems elsewhere in your gardens or anything else because they're very host specific. And those are the kinds of opportunities and areas we need to go to, because I, as a farmer, I have used those types of controls. I've used nematodes to kill out little root borers that are eating out my peppermint roots. Literally, and the nematodes are hunter-killer nematodes. You put them on through the irrigation system. They're live being. You mix them up, come in a clay thing. You mix them up in a 30-gallon drum. You suck them through the irrigation system. They go down, and they literally hunt down these mint root borers. They kill them, and then they propagate themselves again inside.
Maybe more than we want to know.
Yeah. The key point is that I replaced that at twice the expense of what the chemicals would have cost me, because I can use it with no pre-harvest interval. I can put it on the day before I harvest the crop. No harm done to anything. I can't do that with the chemical alternative. It gets back to the liability issue. And the second thing is it's darn safer for me, the farmer, because the stuff I used to have to put on to kill them things, it wasn't a good thing. So it's, you know, the dynamics of this business are changing how we operate. At the same time, we don't want to lose some of our effective tools that we have too, because every now and then you may get a farmer who goes off and does something pretty stupid. By and large, everybody's very responsible because they're scared to death of what the alternatives are if they choose not to be. Representative Salt,
if we figured out intensity of use by square foot as far as volume or weight goes, and then you did an overlay of the whole state, I think I think I've heard something along these lines. You'd find that the amount used per square foot out on a farm is far less than on the yards of applicating fertilizer, herbicide, and pesticide in my neighborhood. And the amount that has been spread on a farm has been done professionally, wisely, with sense, rather than the urban person who goes and buys Roundup or whatever and just pours it on. I And then when you add that intensity of a million people flowing into the Willamette and Columbia River, now you really got a problem on your hands. So yet a lot of this concern beating farmers over the head with this comes from the very place where really the problem is far more intense than it is out in a farm where this stuff's diluted. If applied responsibly, which I believe in the vast majority of times it is, isn't causing the problems that everybody's up in an uproar about. So I think that's another thing I'd like to see is if you have a graph or actually an overlay of the state showing per square foot application or acre, and then the intense use by volume or weight, however I can read that, I'd be interested in seeing that too. It'd be even better if we could do a study and show the proper application, but that's probably never going to be able to be done.
We will see what we can find. And now I need to do a time check with you. We've managed in about 45 minutes to do four measures. We have 26 to go.
We will get through a few more and then probably continue tomorrow and then finish up with agency priorities. One last question on this is, how do you fund this part of your program in terms of investigation?
Mr. Chair, the base pesticide program, which is registration, certification, licensing, investigation, is all other funded through either licenses or pesticide registration fees.
Okay, very good. All right, let's move on. Thank you.
This is performance measure number 13. It measures the number of complaints per approved field burning day. And this looks at how well we're doing in terms of the days that we choose to allow field burning and prevent smoke intrusion into populated areas or try and mitigate it.
And I might add for the committee's sake, you will see a measure that we're proposing to add that tends to get at a more objective measurement of smoke intrusion. These are complaints that can come in, and we actually get complaints on days that we don't burn fields. So this is not, I would say, a real objective measure, but obviously field burning has been another area where there's been a lot of attention, and so this is a measure we've had in place for a few years. I think there were some that reviewed the measure and thought just completely replace this with the other one. That would be a question we would put in front of the body. We will continue to track complaints that we receive. That's part of what we do in our field burning program. But if you wanted us to move this to an internal measure and replace it with the new one we're proposing, that would certainly be an option. We just thought there would be interest in wanting to keep monitoring complaints.
Which one is this on the other sheet here?
Maybe you could point out where the new measure is.
Yeah, where is the new measure?
The new measure.
Yes, Representative Shaw.
You know what I'd like is a cheat sheet on one page showing me what we're keeping, what we're changing, what we're deleting.
Can you actually?
Actually, we have that, Representative.
Oh, we do. Thank you. Is that handed out today?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, your copy of the slides.
Yeah. Oh, it's on there?
We'll have
each measure at the top, you'll notice right now we're going through all the ones that say keep.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one page make it real easy for people.
I think we can do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
You had complaints on the days that you didn't do any burning. That's because of the medical marijuana law.
Clearly.
Okay.
If you've seen the growth of that, we're up to 10,000. There's a lot of puffing going around out there.
A lot of puffing there, Representative.
The economy's turning around just because of what's doing in D.C., I'll tell you what.
Do you want us to talk about the new measure now or wait until we get to it?
Why don't you wait until we get to it and then we'll... Well, no. Let's go ahead and talk since we're on the subject. What are you going to replace this with?
It's new measure 60330. It would be on your spreadsheet that was handed out to you. Page 5. On the bottom, measure 22. or item number 22, performance measure 30. It's not on the, it's not in your book. It's on this thing that's handed out.
Bottom of page 5.
Bottom of page 5. Item number 22. If you move to the right-hand side, actually flip it over to page, the next page, page 6 at the top. The measure is no increase above 2002 levels. That, so 2002 would be our base year. In levels of significant smoke intrusions due to field burning as measured by nephelometer readings. And a nephelometer is an official smoke reading device.
Gotta love them nephelometers.
It's a device that is that actually housed with the Department of Environmental Quality. So they would actually do a measure of smoke intrusion as opposed to what's been perceived smoke intrusion.
And the base 02 year was the high year, was it not? Was that the year you had 40 complaints? I think it was.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. That was the year that we had the most complaints.
Right. So you're going to use that as your base to start from.
And our plan is to do better than that.
Well, it's Willamette Valley. We don't care.
We
took a vote over here. We don't care.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, we were proposing to keep both measures.
Yeah.
That would be one option. One option would be to move the complaints to a secondary internal measure and to replace it with the nephelometer.
And I, in my discussions with the chair, that's kind of the direction I felt she would be important. It is valuable to have this as an internal measure for the agency, but the real issue is field burning intrusions, which you're clearly delineating that in the language here. Significant smoke intrusions to key cities as a result of field burning, and that really is because you know what happens. Sometimes we start slash burns and they go for days, and then we of course get blamed, and they certainly do have a significant impact on the overall quality of the air shed. I would say keep this as an internal measure, but replace it with the one you're proposing. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, let's move on.
This could be a challenging one, so hang with us. Senator Nelson may be able to help.
This is performance measure number 14, and this measures the annual rate of soil and real erosion on cultivated cropland. This was what we are proposing to use to measure how effective the Senate Bill 1010 programs and plans are. One of the challenges that we have with this is the information is measured by USDA NRCS, and it's done on a 5-year interval. And so the first time we would have data available to us would be 2005.
The challenge that we have with finding an appropriate measure for dealing with our Senate Bill 1010 program is, for those of you who don't know, that deals with water quality and agriculture's contribution to water quality. There are many other groups that contribute to water quality in any given region, and we were trying to get at keeping soil runoff, sediment, that kind of stuff out of water basins. That's a big goal of our water quality program. There's been discussions about maybe you should use a turbidity measurement in the water, which we could certainly do, but it would be hard to then say how much of that was due to agriculture's contribution versus something else. So The co-chairs had raised a question around this. We have asked our staff to give it thought once again. It was the same discussion we had when we first established this measure in 2000. We are willing to consider it again, but we're having a hard time, we think, finding a better measure than
this. We also talked about this at length, and what I think is important for us and ultimately for our constituencies to determine what kind of data shows us that Senate Bill 1010 is contributing to less erosion and better water quality. That's really what
where we need to get to. And that really affects both measure number 14 and measure 15, because they're very similar in that regard. And it would be it would also be interesting to note how much money that we're spending also at the same time to produce better water quality from your agency's perspective. In other words, what kind of resources do you broadly put into the water quality issue?
And, Mr. Chairman, obviously we can get at that through the budget. We have staff people that are our implementers for the Senate Bill 1010 program. We also have state resources that go to soil and water districts, which do a lot of on-the-ground work through our agency. You also have state resources that flow through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, so that would be another agency. And that's, you know, really then to watershed councils, which do work with Senate Bill 1010. You've got state resources through Department of Environmental Quality that don't deal with agriculture but deal with other contributors to water quality issues. So we can certainly get you the numbers from our agency.
Do you have a, I mean, you really are involved in a lot of, ODA is involved in a lot of local agencies, water, you know, soil and conservation districts are one of them. Could you provide us with a breakdown of all those agencies that you contribute either in kind through staff time or actual monetary resources to? I've not really seen that, frankly, and it would be interesting to see, and I think it would be instructive for the committee to see how involved ODA is in water quality issues, and then we can marry that up at some point in time with all of the other agencies that Director Kova has just articulated to us, DEQ probably being the largest of them, just so you have a comprehensive understanding of how much time and effort goes into water quality issues at the state level, the local level, and I know you can't provide us with all of that, but it is an amazing amount of time and energy and resources that go into those things. Representative or Senator?
I would just wonder if you could figure out how much in cubic quantities a ton of soil is. I mean, is it, you know, 3x4x6 or... We were talking about, you know, a ton, like that's a lot, but like a ton of concrete, it's not very much, is it? I mean,
it's 27 times 150 pounds cubic square foot equals a yard.
Depends on the PSI of the concrete.
Yeah, that's
like
reinforced.
In terms of
reinforced
concrete. What does it look like? What does the tennis ball look like?
Concrete product of his analysis.
Jeez. It is always good to have Senator Shields back in the room. The quips flow freely. Senator Bates and then Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very complex issue, but obviously one of the, probably the key, if I could pick one key issue for you, this is it. For sustainability, you're talking about water quality and the quality and amount of topsoil you have. And I'm not quite clear from what you've told me whether or not the difficulty here is a scientific way of measuring this. It seems to me like you're trying to measure it sort of secondarily through the quality of the water you're looking at and then trying to determine from that how much soil you're losing, or if it's so complex from the point of view of what works and what doesn't work. I mean, is this cropland we're losing when we look at the water, or is it a result of logging practices, or do we have a dry year or a wet year? We know a certain amount of soil erosion is appropriate, necessary for our estuaries and for our continental shelf. Well, that's lost because of dams. And so we have siltation of dams to deal with. It's a very complex issue, and this is, I'm just talking from 80,000 feet here. So my first question, this graph is what does this really represent? What is the importance of it? I mean, we're talking about a fraction of 1% of the topsoil. Are we talking about a significant loss every year? What's the trend been for the last 20 years? This isn't meaningful to me, looking at one bar graph, one place. Mm-hmm. And as you said, go with us. This is complicated, mm-hmm. and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. What's your sense here? I mean, my sense from what I've watched the last 20 years in Oregon is that things are improving. We're losing less soil than we used to, and the people are becoming more aware of this, but I couldn't tell that from this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I think our sense is that things are improving as well, as noted by the target where it drops down at 205, and that's the next time that USDA will take a measure of the erosion. And so we would expect to see the bar at 205 lower than it was in 2000, because we believe that the efforts that have been made on the ground through the 1010 planning process will help prevent erosion.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I would like to, at another time, give it to us how the USDA measures this. I mean, it looks like the NARCs for the USDA are doing this, and I don't think it's the NARCs, right? NRCS. Those guys aren't NARCs, are they?
Natural Resource Conservation Service.
Oh, okay. I come up from different worlds, okay?
Every couple of years, Senator, it gets a new acronym.
Okay.
Yes,
NARCs
is
probably not the best one you want to use right now. But give me some idea, if you can, how they're measuring this. Not now. I'm sure it's incredibly complex. But that would help us decide if it's really meaningful or not.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we don't believe there's data before 2000. That's part of our other challenge, is just not having the data out there. I think when the Department of Environmental Quality was in front of you, they may have talked about data, some data challenges they have in monitoring water quality. I know part of the reason we've been so successful with the Coastal Coho Initiative is because we put resources into monitoring and actually have data that a lot of other states don't have. So this is, I think, one of the issues we have here is just the ability to access data.
And by the way, Senator, we put in some great local incentives here. It was a bill that you actually voted for.
Oh, my God.
about 4 years ago that I thought up all on my own, believe it or not. Scary thought in its own right. And you know, what it does, it allows a farmer who is growing a crop next to a stream to choose to no longer grow. You can choose to put
I remember now.
Yeah, in fact, you worked with me on that.
Yeah, you're not a modern farmer also. Yeah.
Yeah, and it encourages farmers to grow crops, or actually to not grow crops there, but rather manage it so that it acts as a riparian zone.
Yeah.
It provides a tax credit to the farmer for what they would have received had they grown it as a highly intensive crop. And I'll tell you the value of that as a peppermint farmer. We would grow peppermint right up to the streams. And you have to keep the edges of your mint field clean, otherwise you get a lot of weeds blowing in. So that means you have to kill all the weeds and you have bare ground. Well, every time you irrigate in the summertime, you have a little erosion there. It goes into the stream. It just makes it a little worse and worse. So this idea was, okay, let's go ahead and plant some grass crops there, or let it go back to natural grasses, manage it so it doesn't become a weed issue for yourself and your neighbors. And then it acts as that filtering device, and you're getting a credit. We did that at the 35-foot distance, because that 35-foot distance is the distance then for the federal program on CREP, CREP, which also is an incentive to create those kinds of things. So our farming practices are going back to, as we see a big move, especially in the wheat country, towards no-till now in wheat because of erosion issues, partially also brought on by the cost of diesel fuel and tractors and all of those things. So, and what's interesting is, you know what? We're going back to the farming methods that my granddad used back in the 30s and the 40s of rotations, when we didn't have a lot of herbicides and pesticides to use. And we're going back to those because they're part of an excellent management system for these kinds of things. All right, let's try to get one more done. I'm sorry, Mr. Schaffer, my apologies.
According to my rigorous cheat sheet, which I carried as a laborer, loose soil, dry soil, 75 pounds a square foot, and my quick calculation here, if it's correct, is 2,025 pounds per yard, so it's about a ton a yard, which led me to think with application of fertilizer, both chemical and natural, hopefully the natural kind, which I've spread my share myself, you'd be odd. You could probably easily make up a lot of that. And what I was going to comment on is the chair alluded to the change in how we till. I mean, in my lifetime, when I've driven tractors with plows, it's totally different on a lot of maybe most operations now. So I imagine that number of tons would eventually go down if we have the tilling practices changing and this conscientiousness of even that number right there would eventually go down with all this going on. So my question is, why just 2.5 tons? Why not have that going down to maybe near zero, but our goal to be zero or somewhere in there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, let us go back and ask again about the target. I don't know if zero is attainable.
Well, yeah, okay.
And maybe folks felt 2.5 was attainable at least for these years, and then we see how we do, and then maybe we drop the target down again. But we can revisit that.
Thank you.
We'd love to get to one more measure because
yes,
then that would be the last of just the keep, and then tomorrow we start with the keep modify. This is a measure that basically tracks our trade manager marketing efforts. We market in a number of different places, both domestically and internationally. And what we do is we're tracking with the companies that we work with sales that they actually achieve as a result of our assistance with them. We've got some new measures that look at jobs in terms of what we're trying to do with producers, processors, and keeping and expanding jobs. But we do have a group of staff that work with companies to maintain and expand their markets. And so we believe that this sales data is probably useful data to keep tracking. And our goal, obviously, is to increase sales.
But you are intending to
add some additional ones.
Yeah, to in essence delete this measure and replace it with a no.
Actually, originally, Mr. Chair, we were talking about deleting this, but then we would lose that, and I guess this would be a question for the committee. We have basically, a couple people on staff that really work in terms of the job side, keeping producers, processors in business and trying to help them expand and recruit new processors into the state. But we also have trade managers whose job it is to bring buyers and sellers together and try to help them facilitate trade. And I just wonder if we really want to lose this measure because that is an important part of our marketing efforts.
Okay. Well, we can certainly have that discussion. Absolutely. Yes, Senator.
Just real quick, Mr. Chair. Well, in my performance measure, my book here is different than yours as far as we expect in 06 and 07.
That was an error in the report that we had with that target. So we've made the adjustments here, but what was in your annual report was an error that we found as we were reviewing our measures for the target. That's our target.
Okay. If there's no further questions, thank you all. We will see you again tomorrow, and we'll continue these discussions. We are adjourned.